Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. It's Mumu and Lindsay. Today we have Terrell Hatzilius. She's an instructor at Grand Challenges Program at Georgia Tech. And Terrell, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
So Terrell, let's start with the obvious question. What is an instructor at the Grand Challenges Program at Georgia Tech? What does that mean and what do you do?
Right, so the Grand Challenges Program is actually a new program that Georgia Tech just started really 3 years ago. It began in 2012, and it's a living learning community. The whole purpose of it is for undergraduates to be able to provide engineering solutions to the global challenges that the world is confronting with. So things like healthy food availability, clean water availability, energy renewability, medicine availability around the world. And a lot of these are problems that are very, very complicated, both for technical reasons and for sociological reasons. So what we do is we put the students into small teams of 4 to 8 students, and they get to choose a problem. And usually the problem is something gigantic, like I want to provide clean water for the world, which is obviously a very admirable goal, but it's a little bit big. And they all live in the same dorms because it's a living learning community. So they all live together, so they get to know each other very well and each other's problems very well. And they spend their first year learning about the problem, learning what it is to really know what a problem space is and grappling with how to understand a problem space. Who are the stakeholders? Why does this problem matter? Does the problem matter to that many people? Why hasn't it been solved yet? What are the solutions that have been proposed in the past and why have they failed? Really getting in touch with what the problem is. And then once we feel like they have an adequate grasp on the problem, then we let them start thinking about solutions. They're not really permitted to think about solutions before they have come to an adequate understanding of the problem, because that's putting the cart before the horse, right? You can't solve something that you don't understand. And so after that, then they start proposing solutions, and our role as their instructors and professors is to really guide them through the solution process to come up with something that's very critically and well thought out, and that's also a very quantifiable solution. So they propose solutions, we kind of poke holes in their solution and guide them and point out why things may or may not work, and then the thing that really makes it unique is we give them money. We give them an actual way to implement these solutions in society and the means to build whatever device they want to build that will help with malaria detection, or to institute whatever program that will help with undergraduate anxiety and help combat undergraduate depression. So we give them all the means to actually do this, and then they actually go out and they actually do implement these solutions in society. So they've done some really, really great work. We've had one team was very interested in malaria detection. I mentioned them briefly earlier. And when they initially came in, they wanted to use temperature. They wanted to create some sort of device, some sort of wearable device that would use temperature for malaria detection. And we were like, well, that's really not very specific. Malaria is a little bit broad.
Here, or it's hot outside. Temperature's malaria. Broader.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they want to be a wearable device that, you know, if they would measure how an individual's temperature fluctuated. But individual temperatures fluctuate for all kinds of reasons and for all kinds of diseases. So it wasn't specific enough. And so we send them to the CDC. One of the great things about being in Atlanta is that we have access to the CDC. So we sent them to the CDC, and they met with some of the world's experts in the field of malaria and treating malaria, and they came up with a new idea. So now what they are doing, and they've actually have done this, is they created a computer learning algorithm that you feed in images of malarial parasites on blood smears, and it is able to keep learning and keep teaching itself and detect both the density of the malarial parasite as well as the species of the parasite. And then all this information is getting collected, and so they are going to be essentially be creating a map of how malaria is spreading across the world and what species are present where, how prevalent it is. It's going to be actually, I think, incredibly useful. And so, like I mentioned, they've actually created the first stage of this computer learning algorithm of the software, and now they're moving on to the next step, which is refining it on a larger scale, obviously, but then also creating a device that it can work inside of. So that's the sort of things that we're trying to do in this program.
Are these freshmen? Or what? These are undergrads? Like, is it a 4-year thing? It just seems like such a, I mean, it's a big project.
Yeah. So they come in as freshmen. They all live in the same dorm as freshmen. There's 110 students each class. And when I get them, because I teach the sophomore year and then also the junior year. So when I get them is after they propose their solution. So this is when they had proposed, for example, their temperature solution. But it's not really, hasn't been something they've implemented yet. And so I really have, I think, the most enjoyable and kind of the most fun job, and that I get to be with them when they are really struggling with it and really trying to implement it. It's great to talk about it, and that's, you know, very hard and difficult also, but you don't really know how hard a problem is until you start working on it day in and day out and actually trying to build it and actually troubleshooting it. So in their sophomore year is when they start beginning to implement, and then at the end of their sophomore year, they should have some sort of product. So these students, the malaria team, and they are an amazing group of students. They are just very, very creative, very persistent, very motivated. They are wonderful, a wonderful group of students. At the end of their sophomore year, they had created this computer learning algorithm that could, in small data sets, distinguish malaria in blood cells. But they have to expand that. So that's what they're going to be doing next year.
So what exactly, you mentioned you're a professor, like an instructor, but what exactly do you teach? Do you teach everything, or are you like the resource for... I mean, I know your background is in science. Is you the resource for science? I mean, what is your role in that?
Right. So I oversee every single team of students. So I meet with every single team of students individually each week,
How many teams are there? You said it's like four students per team?
Yeah. So it's 4 to 8 students per team. 4 is really the minimum. We don't let the teams go smaller than that because otherwise the teamwork dynamic is lost a little bit. Last year, I had 14 teams in the fall. This year, I have 13 teams in the fall. So it's quite a bit of time meeting with each group every single week. But it's wonderful, and it's very, very rewarding to do it. So I get to learn a lot about a lot of different topics that I had no idea about, which is wonderful. You know, my background is in neuroscience, so I know neuroscience. But now I'm learning all about malaria detection, and I have another group of students that's interested in creating a device that you could plug your, they're interested in vampire energy, so they're interested in creating a device that you could plug all of your devices into that would stop vampire energy from drawing energy from your device when it's in the off mode. So I'm learning all about electrical engineering because my job is to make sure that they are creating the appropriate test to test their device, and of course, obviously, in electrical engineering, that they're being safe. So there's a lot of different topics that come into play, which make it incredibly interesting.
Do you find students, I mean, are these all engineering students, or are these kids that sort of don't, that are like cross-discipline types?
So it is cross-discipline because it's Georgia Tech. The majority are engineering students.
Right.
So a lot of the solutions have an engineering bent. But the students, the teams themselves are cross-disciplinary, which I think is really one of their strengths because you get trained a certain way. And when everybody's in whatever discipline you're in mechanical engineering, in civil engineering, in neuroscience, in psychology, you get trained a certain way in each discipline. And when everybody's coming from the same background, you get very, very focused. And it's very easy to lose track of alternate viewpoints, alternate solutions. It's really great to have that sort of cross-section of disciplines coming together.
So are students getting course credit for this, or are they taking on a full course load aside from this project that they're working on?
No, they get course credit. They get course credit their freshman and sophomore years. Their junior year, they don't get course credit anymore.
But they're probably also invested in it at that point.
Right. But yeah, they're very invested in it at that point. And like I said, they're doing some really amazing work. So by the time they reach their junior year, they are pretty much able to function on their own.
That's really cool. So I know Moon was about to ask this, but what is your background? You mentioned your background is neuroscience. Can you tell us a little bit about your winding path to where you are now,
right,
through neuroscience?
So it has definitely been a winding path. My PhD is in neuroscience, and I went to Emory University. I specifically was researching neurodegenerative diseases. I was researching ALS, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as motor neuron disease, or more colloquially as Lou Gehrig's disease. Well, one of the reasons I really enjoyed this topic so much is because it had such relevance to patients. So one of the things that made me, that was incredibly lucky, was that when I was in my PhD program, my advisor was actually the head of the ALS Center at Emory. And because of that, I was able to interact with the patient some. And he actually really pushed that. He encouraged me very strongly to come to ALS clinic with him. And that was for many reasons. One was to keep me grounded. One was to make sure that I realized that this isn't just something that I'm reading in a textbook. This is a disease that real people have. And it devastates their lives and it devastates their loved ones' lives. And we need to come up with a way to treat it, not because it's interesting, although it is, but because it's their lives. And the other reason why he wanted me to come to ALS clinic was so that I could see how incredibly varied the disease is. So when you're working on animal models, you have these animals that have all been bred to be exactly the same, right? You want to have animals that are as similar to each other as possible so that you can actually compare them in experiments. There's a good, very good reason for that, and that's the way that we should do it. But when you're working with a disease that's a little bit varied, then it's easy to try to generalize something from a homogenous population to a larger, very different population. And so that's one of the other reasons why he really insisted they came to clinic, was so that I could see in some patients you have onset in their foot, in some patients you have onset in their hand, some patients get bulbar onset, which is in their throat. So it's a very different sort of situation that you're in, and it's important to keep that in mind in any sort of science that you're working on, that the laboratory condition is not the same as the applied condition. So, I'm sorry, that totally went away from what we were talking about before.
That's actually, to me, it's really interesting, because I think we forget, you know, these people spend, you know, you spend years in a lab doing something, and you've discovered something, and you write a paper on it, and then yet it doesn't apply to real life, or it's just so not relevant to what's going on in the real world with the thing you're trying to cure, or it's so far removed that it's, you just lose that. I don't know. I feel like that's a big gap.
Right. Yes. I think that's definitely very, very true. And it's definitely one of the things that he emphasized a lot was research for research's sake is wonderful and great. And I'm very much a fan of that, but it's also important to remember that there are people that are being impacted by it as well.
So how did you feel about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge? It's actually been a year since that's happened. I was just wondering what your take on that was.
Right. So I participated in the Ice Bucket Challenge. I was challenged to it by my niece. And I participated and also obviously donated. One of the things is that got a little bit lost was that people didn't realize that they were supposed to also donate in addition to doing the Ice Bucket Challenge. But I thought it was great because it increased visibility for the disease. And I know that since then there's been a lot of arguments and maybe disagreements about how the money was used, where it should have gone. And I'm not honestly 100% certain where it did go, how it was allocated. I've heard different things from different places, and I don't really know. But what I do know is that a lot of people who had no idea what ALS was now are able to recognize it. So when I first began speaking to you guys, I said I worked on ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as motor neuron disease, or Lou Gehrig's disease. I said that because that's my standard spiel. I've learned through the past.
You don't have to say that anymore.
Right, I don't have to do it anymore, and I'm used to doing it. But it's great to realize that if I say ALS, people are like, oh yeah, which is, it's wonderful because it is a disease that's not really that prevalent, and It's not as prevalent as Alzheimer's disease, is what I should say. It is more prevalent than people realize, but it's not as prevalent as Alzheimer's disease. But beyond that, when people get ALS, they are isolated. They tend to stay inside because it's very difficult for them to move. And even more tragically, they tend to die very, very quickly. So you don't see ALS patients because lots of times they don't live long enough for you to see them. And that's awful. That's a terrible reason to have their disease be forgotten. And it's really, really wonderful, I think, that people are able to recognize that disease as something that needs to be investigated, something that is a very, very pressing concern and that deserves to be investigated.
Dealing with students and also sort of working in labs and stuff, what do you see in terms of like what your students come in with? I mean, obviously it's Georgia Tech, so they're engineering oriented, mm-hmm. but are people like, this is what I want to do with my life and I want to do this? Or are they sort of like, I can be an entrepreneur and do whatever I want?
Such an interesting question because the answer is so varied. So there are, of course, the students that come in that say, you know, I 100% know exactly what I want to do. I'll never forget last year we had a guest speaker in class, and he was trying to make the point that people kind of learn their interests as they age. And he was polling the class. It was the first year class. There were 110 students. And he said, how many of you guys knew that you wanted to, what you wanted to be when you were children? And this one girl raised her hand, and he said, oh, and what did you know you wanted to be? And she said, I knew I wanted to be an industrial engineer. And we almost kind of looked at her, and we were like,
who are you?
Probably what? Didn't know that as a five-year-old. As a five-year-old, you probably did not know what those words meant. But there are students that come in very focused. That's the point from that. There are students that come in very, very focused. And whether they knew it when they were five doesn't really matter. The important thing is that they, some of them come in absolutely 100%. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a civil engineer, or I'm going to do Be It Me, and I'm going to create this device that's going to help during cardiac surgery. You know, there's all kinds of people that come in, they know 100%. But then there's also one of the things that I love about Georgia Tech, and that I really didn't know about it until I started working there. There's this amazing entrepreneurial just vibe throughout the entire campus. And there's a lot of resources on campus for the students. They have a startup, you can do something called Startup Semester, they have startup boot camps, there's something called the ATDC, which is the Advanced Technology Development Center, and it's just a startup incubator. It's on Georgia Tech campus. It's not exactly associated with Georgia Tech, but it's on Georgia Tech campus in Georgia Tech buildings. And one of the things that we encourage our students to do is to think about their teams as kind of their own little businesses and to run them as their own little businesses. Georgia Tech has this amazing startup culture. My husband is a Georgia Tech graduate, and he founded and owns his own company in the engineering field. And that's one of the things I think that Georgia Tech has done remarkably well, better than pretty much any other school that I have really seen up to this point, although given I have the most familiarity with Georgia Tech, so obviously I'm a little bit biased in that. They really do set their students up for success in the fields of entrepreneurship.
Stepping back a little bit, how did you get interested in science in general? So how did you know that you wanted what you wanted to major in and that you wanted to pursue a PhD?
Okay, that's a very interesting question.
And actually, besides TJ, of course.
Right, besides TJ. So that question kind of leads into something else that I did kind of in my long winding path to where I am now, which is neuroethics. But I'll get to that in a second. So I always loved science from the time I was a child. I thought it was so interesting, a way that you could really understand what's going on in the world. And then I started learning about neuroscience, and I was blown away by the idea that who you are on a fundamental level is boiled down to cells, that everything is just boiled down to chemistry and biology. And all the things that make me are just the cells of my body acting in a certain way. So that idea first was interesting to me, and then I started learning about neurodegenerative diseases, and I started learning about Alzheimer's disease in specific. And in Alzheimer's disease, you know, a few things happen. Obviously, you lose your memory, and your personality also can change a little bit. And so your thought patterns, how you react to things, that can change. And this is a little bit metaphysical, but this idea of who you are and what defines you, and that it can change as your biology changes, was just absolutely overwhelmingly fascinating to me. I could not get away from this idea that all we are is how our cells are interacting with each other. And so that is how I initially got into neuroscience, was because I was so interested in Alzheimer's disease, and I was so interested in what defines a person, what makes Lindsay Lindsay, and moo 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 moo, and what makes Terrell Terrell, you know. And how does that change as our cells change? And how does that change in the disease process? And how can that be treated? It was just so overwhelmingly interesting to me. And so while I was in graduate school, I still, you know, I wasn't researching Alzheimer's anymore. I was researching ALS, obviously. But I still kept thinking about this idea, thinking about the different ethics that are associated with neuroscience. And so that was, you know, why I... So that's how I got to neuroscience in the first place. But then in terms of thinking about the ethics associated with it, I started getting interested in this field of neuroethics. And it's a new field. Probably in the last 10 years is really when it's kind of begun to grow rapidly. But it's the idea of, well, there's kind of two sides of neuroethics. So there's the ethics of neuroscience. So what are the ethical implications of what we're doing? Should we be creating cognitive enhancing psychopharmacology? Should we be using fMRI in the courtroom? Should we be using fMRI to determine when prisoners should be released from prison, if they're more likely to reoffend or not? So that's that sort of side of it. And there's the other side, which is the consciousness and the free will side. So the neuroscience of ethics, I guess. So how do we come to these ideas of free will? How much free will do we actually have? And so there's kind of the two fields, and they diverge and they come back together and they diverge again. They're obviously quite interrelated. But go ahead.
I was going to ask, which side did you sort of work on or look into?
Right. So I worked for the Neuroethics Society briefly. And I also did an internship at AAAS, which is the American Association of the Advancement of Science, looking into science policy issues like this. And the thing that I found the most interesting was, well, I don't know, it's also interesting. One of the things that I know, it's hard to tell. I was really interested in the way that neuroscience is applied in the world and a little bit concerned about the way that neuroscience is being applied in the world. It's very, very complicated. We don't understand a lot of how the brain works. We're beginning to understand. We're beginning to learn a little bit more about what different signals mean and how different neurons connect with each other. But there's a lot we just don't know. And especially when it comes to human behavior, there's a lot we just don't know. And one of the things that was really concerning to me was this idea of using fMRI in the courtroom. And so it has been used both in terms of defense of the accused. So if there's an average brain and then the accused individual has a brain that somehow is abnormal, that's different in some way, then their lawyer can say they never had a normal brain, normal in quotes obviously, to begin with. So how could they be expected to act rationally? How could they be expected to act in a responsible manner? They're not responsible for their actions. And if they didn't act intentionally, you can't convict them. So it has actually been used in the courtroom in this way. There have been situations where they have looked at impulse control and shown this person has lower impulse control.
No, this is the whole Minority Report stuff, right? I mean, like, if we know that you are predisposed to this behavior patterns or your brain has this chemical in it that predisposes you to violence, then therefore we should lock you up, right?
Right, and I don't think that anybody's advocating that, but the point is that it's not well understood yet, and it's something that these are important questions to think about. So it has been shown, there has been a study that was done on prisoners in which they were doing fMRI, and they had them do an impulse control task, and they looked and they saw who had higher or lower activities of, who had higher or lower activity in the anterior cingulate cortex, which is an area in the brain. And those who had lower electrical activity in that area in the brain were more likely to reoffend. And so then the question is, okay, well, should you do those tasks before you release people? Well, that doesn't really seem, I don't think that's very, I personally don't think it's appropriate to apply that to the individual. But these are the questions that people are grappling with, and as we're learning more and more about them, these are the things we're going to have to start thinking about. So that was kind of the side of it that I was really, really interested in. But there's also, you know, this whole idea of free will is also quite interesting as well. So neuroethics is just this field that's just exploding right now.
Well, plus it makes for good news headlines.
It makes news headlines, yeah.
Yeah, and me as a journalist would be like, ooh, got, you know, man arrested for child pornography had a tumor in his brain. Is that what caused his habit, you know, his pornography problem, or was it him, you know, can you get him off, can he be, exonerated for it or not?
Right. It makes amazing headlines. And also there's always the problem of just the fMRI to look pretty. You put an fMRI up in the courtroom and it looks pretty, and it's hard for people to understand what it does and it doesn't mean, but it looks very scientific. So there's that issue as well. But yeah, it makes for amazing headlines, and it's incredibly interesting, but it's also something that, you know, we just need to think about a little bit.
So are you no longer working in this area now that you're a teacher at for this Grand Challenges program?
Yeah, so it makes me kind of really sad, actually, because I actually really loved it. But it was so interesting, and I loved interacting with the leaders in the field who are working on these questions. There's just so many fascinating things to think about, but there's just only so much time in the day. There's just really so much time in the day, you know? And then in addition to that, then I do some medical writing in my spare time, and so that, in addition to the Grand Challenges program, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I still try to keep up with it sometimes, but it's not as readily available, so I'm not always as up to speed on it, you know? But I still would like to get back involved with it again. If one of my teams, oh, this would be amazing. If one of my teams wanted to do something with neuroethics.
You should just start hinting. Being like,
right.
Like, I have all these resources. I know all these people. I'd be happy to help you.
Well, it's remarkable to me that none of them have actually done anything on the neuroscience track yet. I guess they have done, they've done psychology. They've done anxiety, depression, but none of them have done anything on the neuroscience track yet. And that may just be because that's something that's very, very difficult to do as an undergraduate student without a lab.
So now you've mentioned that the program is 3 years old. So that means that the freshmen coming in haven't graduated yet, correct?
Right.
So are there, you know, assuming that these projects go well, are there plans for them to, you know, patent these things and market these things?
Yeah, actually, one of my teams sold some software. They has actually sold their software. Not the team I was telling you about, not the malaria team, but a different team has actually been able to sell their software to a different private company. I had another team who was looking into patenting their product. I don't feel like I should say what their product was because I don't want anybody to take their idea.
Sure.
But I have had teams that are looking into patenting products also. The team that's looking into anxiety and depression in students, they've been actually working with the Georgia Tech Counseling Center, who has been amazing. They've really, really gone out of their way to help these students and try to incorporate their program into the Georgia Tech Counseling Center. And it sounds like they have intentions to incorporate it on the large scale to really make it part of the program, which is amazing as well. So these are ideas that are going to continue. And it's really up to them to see what they're going to do with it. I know that my malaria team wants to patent their device once they finish it also. So these are things that are actually going to be real products in the world.
It's really, it must be fascinating to watch this stuff and to hear these ideas and then see what happens with it.
Right. Yes. And sometimes they say something and it's, you just know it's not going to work, but I just can't tell them that, you know, I have to ask the questions to get them there first. And then when that happens and then they start thinking about, well, that won't work, but maybe if we approach it from this way, that won't work either. But maybe if we do that, and you watch them build and build and build and build, and it's wonderful. And at the end, it's theirs. I didn't hand them the solution. I didn't say to them, you have to go do this. I helped push them. I helped poke holes, or maybe it was a little bit weaker, but it's theirs. And because it's theirs, they love it. They love it, and they just think about it all the time, and they talk about it all the time, and it becomes their baby. And I think that's really, really important and irreplaceable in their development as critical thinkers.
Now, is this a Georgia Tech only program in that you're the only university that offers it, or
yep.
If this ends up being hugely successful, would this be a model for something that other universities would like want to try?
Well, right now we are the only program like this. So other universities have living learning communities. I was in one when I was at Duke. Lots of universities have living and learning communities, and they have all, for the large part, been extraordinarily successful. Students respond really well to that environment. In terms of the Grand Challenges program, there is the National Academy of Engineers has a Grand Challenge Scholars program, but that's different. That's targeted more on individual students. It's not really as team-oriented, and there's different they have different goalposts than what our students have. We're the only program like this in the country. The National Academy of Engineers has actually expressed a great deal of interest in our program because our students are so successful and have created things that have been utilized on the larger scale outside of Georgia Tech. But we're the only program like this in the country. And I guess the hope would be that other schools would follow suit, but we'll just have to see what happens with that.
I know Mumu's staking a claim for Maryland.
I'm trying to think long term now.
I know you do so many different things in your field and your job. What surprises you? Is there something that some topic or some area or something you gets you really excited and surprises you, or you can't wait to see what happens next?
Well, since we've covered so many things, there's so many things that do surprise me, but I just love watching the field of ALS develop. And that sounds like a weird thing to say because you should never use the word love with anything with ALS because it's a tragic disease, but I love watching the research develop around that field, which is why I'm so interested to see that article that you guys are going to send me. It's so fascinating to me how rapidly it has changed in the last few years. The developments and the advances that have been made are amazing, and we don't have a cure yet. And we don't really, honestly, even have a very good treatment yet, but we're learning. We're learning quickly, and we're going to be able to apply that soon. And that's one of the things that I love is just watching therapies develop and really remembering why we got into this whole beautiful field of science in the first place.
Well, that's really cool. Well, Terrell, thank you so much for joining us. This has been fun. And that whole program sounds really cool, like something I would have wanted to do in college.
Yeah, I know. I wish they'd had it when I was in college, too. I mean, don't get me wrong. I loved my living learning community, but this also sounds amazing. So
yeah, you come out of college and you have a patented product and, you know, a startup going on the back burner and, you know, no big deal.
It's a nice way to start. It's a nice way to start.
I hope we get updates of these students when they're done with their project.
I will definitely send them to you.
Wonderful.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Moo Moo Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.